Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Later in the show, as usual, I'll turn to you, inviting you to call in for what I call a three-minute workover. I'll try to help you with your work problem. But first, when I'm a guest on a call-in show outside the Bay Area, people are most interested in jobs in a company. But here on this show, here in the Bay Area, most people are interested in government jobs, nonprofit jobs. And it is nonprofit work that I'm going to focus on in this segment of Work with Marty Nemko. Alas, many nonprofit jobs are volunteer jobs or very low-pay jobs. Well, two exceptions are fundraiser and being a consultant in nonprofits. With me is a woman who's written a book on each. One's called Fundraising as a Career. I love the subtitle. What? Are you crazy? And the Nonprofit Consulting Playbook, subtitle Winning Strategies from 25 Leaders in the Field. But she's far from just a writer about it. She's done it since 1993. She's managed capital campaigns. She's helped dozens of nonprofits achieve their goals and trained more than 3,000 people on fundraising in the U.S., in Mexico, Canada, Egypt. Linda Lysakowski, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks so much, Marty. It's great to be here.
What's the deal with Egypt?
Oh, well, I was called over there about 10, 12 years ago, I guess, to do some training for American University in Cairo. And I've also been to Bermuda and trained at the Center on Philanthropy there.
Tell me something that would surprise me about fundraising in either in Egypt or in the Caribbean that I might not know.
Well, one of the things that surprised me when I went to Bermuda was that they raise a lot more money from corporations in Bermuda than they do in the United States, percentage-wise. So that was a surprise to me. Partly it shows us that we could be doing better raising money from businesses, but partly it shows me that they could be doing better raising money from individuals. So that was probably the biggest surprise.
Okay. Well, something I found very interesting in the introduction to your book, Fundraising as a Career, you lament that the pressure on nonprofits to reduce expenditures on fundraising. I mean, normally we're trying to look for, you know, we as a donor might look for a nonprofit that doesn't spend a lot of money on the fundraising, but more on the program. Why do you lament the pressure on nonprofits to reduce expenditures on fundraising?
Well, I think because we have to understand that there's an old saying in fundraising, no money, no mission, and it's really true that fundraising is really a program of a nonprofit, because without fundraising, there isn't going to be money to deliver programs. And a lot of boards and even the executive directors don't always understand that. They kind of look at philanthropy with that old tin cup mentality that, gosh, you know, we're a poor nonprofit, we don't spend any money, and so you need to give us some money. And I think the question that nonprofit boards and leadership really need to ask themselves is, are we spending enough money on fundraising rather than are we spending too much?
Well, I'm just curious. You know, if it would seem to me that if my nonprofit cause was that good and it really was providing great service and great benefit, I wouldn't need to spend all that money on the selling aspect. The sales, it would be pretty obvious. Like, I think about Smile Train, and I hear them talk about the fact that for $250, they can take a life that is, you know, pretty much going to be pretty devastating. We're such an unfortunately lookist world. So somebody's got a cleft palate, and no matter what, the kid could be a genius, and it's going to go nowhere. But for $250, we can take that young child and cure his cleft palate. So it seems like that's yielding a lot of bang for the buck. It would seem that you don't need to spend a fortune on fundraising in order to raise money for an obviously good cause like that. Isn't it possible that when you're asking companies or nonprofits to devote more of their resources, reallocate from providing program to fundraising, is maybe the root problem that the cause isn't worthy enough?
Well, I think what the issue is that there are so many nonprofits. I mean, in the United States alone, there are about 1.5 million nonprofit organizations. So, yes, some have really obvious causes and they're well-known, but those well-known causes are only well-known because they've spent a lot of money on marketing and things like that to get their cause better known in the community. So the poor nonprofit that is low budget and is struggling to compete with depending on the size of their community, maybe dozens of other nonprofits, maybe hundreds, maybe even thousands of nonprofits, they don't really stand a chance when they're up against organizations that have invested money to get their causes out there and get them known to the general community. So I think it does deserve some money being put into this, because otherwise people don't have their causes known, and without public awareness, it's hard to raise money.
All right, let's turn to the, you know, the show focuses on career. So in a typical kind of moderate-sized nonprofit, there are these very main kind of categories. There's a director of development or, you know, fundraising. There's an administrative assistant to that director. There's an events coordinator who puts on the flashy gala, the, you know, Vegas night or whatever crap that they do to try to extort money. And then there is a major and planned gifts director, you know, getting you to leave all your money to them in your charitable remainder trust. Then there's a director of annual giving who tries to come up with an explanation for why every year this is the year you got to do it. And then there's a director of research and grants, like prospect researchers who do the research on fat cats. Other than my little snarky descriptions of them, tell me something interesting I might know about each of those job descriptions. I mean, I just start with the director.
Well, I think the director of development, one of the interesting things that I've seen in the change since many, many years, I've been in this field for about 30 years, is that it's becoming thought of much more of as a profession. And a true director of development needs to kind of be the jack of all trades or Jill of all trades and be able to really know a little bit about all of those things that you mentioned, grants, events, you know, annual giving, research. But it really takes a person with a lot of skill and to understand both the art and the science of fundraising, because it's really both. It's an art and it's a science.
And, of course, a career like that, that's the career that pays. We always hear about nonprofit salaries, and some critics will say, you know, how dare these nonprofit people make $300,000 or $500,000 a year? If they really were that committed to the cause, they'd live more modestly and donate it to the charity. But it's still a capitalist supply-demand thing, and it's just that it requires a very high-level skill. Is that fair?
Yes, I think so. And really, I came from the banking world, and I was committed to my job and believed very strongly in the institution I worked for, but that didn't mean that I would work for a bank for free, so it really shouldn't mean that in a nonprofit community either.
What made you decide to move? You know, we especially here in the Bay Area, banks are seen as the big evil. You said you believed in the cause. If you believed in the cause, what made you believe in banking as a cause? And then what made you move to the nonprofit sector, honestly?
Well, I think banking and or any business, really, people need to believe in the mission of what their organization is doing. And I saw that our bank was doing a lot of good in the community through community reinvestment and education and things like that that were all critical. But what made me kind of move from the dark side, I guess, was really my involvement in the nonprofit community, where I thought I really had an opportunity to be more of a change agent and really work nitty-gritty with the nonprofit community that really benefited from people with a business background. So I thought it was a great career move to go from a business environment to a nonprofit, because the nonprofits needed to learn some business techniques and business strategies, and the combination was just ideal for me at the time.
I've heard actually that while, yes, they, you know, many nonprofits will hold their nose and say we need somebody who's business oriented to raise money or lend a level of professionalization to this organization, they really are, there is an internal bias against people in the for-profit sector. You call them the dark side. To what extent is that true?
Well, I think there is probably some, and I think it's both sides can really learn from each other. I think that's what's ideal about the United States is, you know, we have three sectors. We have government, which is another whole story, but we have business and we have the nonprofit sector, and working together, we can really do a lot of fantastic things. So I think both sides need to learn more about each other. The nonprofit community needs to learn how to work more like a business, but I think the business community can learn a lot from the nonprofit sector too. And during the recession, I think we found that out very clearly, that businesses had to learn to do with a lot less, just as nonprofits have always been able to do amazing things with very few resources.
Tell me about, you know, you said you spent 30 years now in this nonprofit sector.
Right.
What is the moment in your life where you felt you made the biggest difference?
Oh, my gosh. It's really hard to pin one down. But I really think that the way I make the most difference now is through my writing. I'm able to...
Me too.
Just leave a legacy for future fundraisers. Mm-hmm. I just came back from a conference, and several people came up to me who I did not know and said, oh, I love your books, mm-hmm. and I really learned so much from your books. And to me, that's making a big difference, because I'm not only affecting one organization, but I'm affecting hundreds, maybe thousands of organizations.
Completely agree. I love to write as well. I love my career counseling, but I also love writing. And this is as good a time as any to let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Linda Lysakowski. She is the author of a number of books, two of which I'll highlight here. One is called Fundraising as a Career, subtitle, What Are You Crazy? And the Nonprofit Consulting Playbook, Winning Strategies from 25 Leaders in the Field. Okay, tell me something I don't know that's we might find interesting about one of the other major jobs in the nonprofit sector, an admin to, you know, a events coordinator, a planned giving director, annual whatever, director of research. Tell me something that might surprise me.
Well, I think one of the jobs that always surprises people is the administrative assistant or the development assistant or whatever title that person has. And sometimes people think, oh, that's a job anybody can do, and, you know, we can pay them minimum wage. But to me, the administrator, the person who administers the database particularly, is probably one of the most important people in the development office, because they are controlling the critical data that all the other fundraisers need, like the major gift people, and really oftentimes maintaining those donor relationships, making sure thank you letters get out on a prompt basis, and making sure that names get changed and addresses get changed when they need to do. And sometimes we think of that as a menial job, but it's a critical job in the development office, and it's a great entry-level job for someone who's thinking about this as a career, because you'll learn a lot about fundraising just managing that database.
Makes infinite sense. Seems to me like that's one of those jobs that you're going to have to get by networking, because there's a lot of people who have those kind of skills. And there are very few of those jobs that pay decently. Is it right that it's schmooze or lose regarding this? This kind of getting this kind of job?
I think so, because donors today are far more sophisticated than they used to be, and they don't no longer just write out that check periodically for their favorite charity. They want to know, what's the charity doing with my money?
No, I don't mean that. I mean that to get in that job as the administrative assistant, you're not going to just answer an ad, because many people have that, those kind of admin detail-oriented skills. You've got to schmooze your way into the job. Is that incorrect?
I think so. Not necessarily always, but for many cases, you know, that's how you get involved with an organization, maybe by volunteering first before you really apply for a full-time job. And showing people that you really do want to grow in your position, that's the kind of person I would look for when I'm hiring an administrative assistant.
And isn't that volunteering thing a trap? You know, so many people try to volunteer their way into an organization, but it's like Russian roulette. You know, your chances of turning that volunteer gig into a middle-class paying job are very low. For every 10 people who volunteer, maybe one end up making a middle-class living. Is the volunteer thing a potential trap?
Well, it could be. I mean, I don't think every volunteer is going to get placed into a position, but nor does every volunteer want to do that. There are many reasons for volunteering. Some people do it just because they have time to fill, or they want to give back to an organization, or maybe they are new to a community and they want to increase their own networks. But I got my job from being a volunteer, and that's, in fact, the name of the book, What Are You Crazy?, came from the comments that I got when I told people I was leaving the banking world and going into development and working for a nonprofit. They said, are you crazy? Why would you do that? Why would you give up a promising career in banking to work for a nonprofit organization? But I started as a volunteer, and I actually went in there thinking, I didn't know people actually got paid to do this, and I was shocked when I found out it was an actual career and people got paid, and sometimes people got paid very well.
I know. Did you do anything unusual to differentiate yourself from the other volunteers to become paid in it, or was it just luck, or what do you really think enabled you to go from being one of those many volunteers to somebody who actually made a living doing it?
Well, I think part of it was a little bit of input on my part. For example, what I was volunteering for was helping people do a corporate annual appeal. And when I went to this nonprofit organization, I found that, first of all, they were meeting with business leaders at 9:30 in the morning. This was on the East Coast, where things are even a little bit more high-powered probably than where I am now on the West Coast. But I found that they were meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning and having meetings last for 2 hours. And I went in and talked to the vice president, and I said, you know, I think you could improve attendance at these meetings by starting them at 7:30 in the morning and getting business leaders out of here at 8:30, because this is how business operates. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I gave them a lot of good insights mm-hmm, onto mm-hmm. how to really work with the business community. And I think because I took a little bit of a stand on some of these things and gave some great advice, my name came to the top of the pile when they were looking to fill a position.
Makes great sense. You know, you talked about the fact that these people shouldn't get minimum wage. We're also talking about volunteers. But, you know, I guess we all have our little things that annoy us, pet peeves. Mine is hypocrisy. And I really do lament the fact that so many nonprofits, even those that champion worker rights, will convert many would-be paying positions to either volunteer positions or minimum wage positions or whatever. How can nonprofits look themselves in the eye and not think of themselves as just disgusting hypocrites by using volunteers and very low-pay workers, not allowing them to live a living wage?
Well, I think that if they're underpaying their workers, then I think they don't deserve to look themselves in the eye. But volunteers are a different story because, as I said, people volunteer for various reasons. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with involving volunteers, but you shouldn't expect a volunteer to do a staff position because volunteers aren't going to be there 40 hours a week. And, of course, in development, it's never a 40-hour week. It's more like a 60-hour week for most of us in this field. But I do think that there's a valid place for volunteerism in the nonprofit sector. And, you know, businesses who, for example, have a volunteer program find that their employees are happier because they're giving opportunities to get out and give back to the community. So I think volunteerism is a great thing, but you should never try to replace a full-time job and say, oh, well, we can get a volunteer to do that free. But that's not the way to look at it. There are volunteer roles and there are staff roles, and both are important in the nonprofit sector.
Would you say that's ideal, but is in the trenches, which is the kind of the name of the whole series of your books, is it not fair to say that in the real world, many, many nonprofits do say, you know, we can get volunteers to do that. We don't need to pay somebody to do it?
I think some do, and that's sad for those organizations who are doing that. But I think the majority of nonprofits really, truly do see volunteerism as just part of what they are doing. And more are becoming to see the reality that if you want to have good development people, you do need to pay a fair and honest wage. And I think donors are beginning to understand that more, too. As a consultant, I know sometimes people will say, oh, gosh, you know, those consultants charge an arm and a leg. But you're paying for their knowledge and their expertise, not for their hours. And so I think, you know, a lot of more nonprofits are starting to see the reality that it is a business, and if you don't operate like a business, you're not going to be around and you're not going to be able to attract the top quality people. You can pay somebody a low wage, but you might get low performance. So if you pay somebody a fair and reasonable wage for a professional fundraiser, then you're going to get someone who has the professional expertise to do what you need done.
This kind of takes us into the whole world of ethics. And so one of the things I liked best about your book, Fundraising as a Career, What Are You Crazy?, was you stress the importance of good ethics. Now, a lot of people wouldn't think that being in the fundraising business had a large ethical component, but that's wrong. Tell us what is a really typical dilemma, not an easy one, but a typical tough ethical dilemma that a fundraising professional might face.
Well, there's a couple of dilemmas. One is especially true in the consulting arena, but also even sometimes with staff. The Association of Fundraising Professionals and most other, that's the largest organization of fundraisers, but there's other organizations, and they all have a code of ethics that say it's not ethical to work on a percentage-based, commission basis. So sometimes as a consultant, I constantly would hear people say, well, can we pay you 10% of the money you raise? And That is not ethical. So that's a big temptation.
Why?
For a lot
that's one I never understood, actually. Why is that unethical?
Well, I think there's a whole, I could probably go on for several hours on why it's unethical, but it boils down to it's donors' money that you're dealing with, and it's not unethical to give a development person a bonus if everybody else in your organization gets a bonus and it's not based on the amount of money they raise. But this is, fundraising is not just a transaction, it's building relationships. And oftentimes, you mentioned earlier planned giving people, someone might be in a planned giving position where they have cultivated a relationship over the last 10 years, and then they leave that job, somebody else comes in, that person dies and leaves $3 million in their will. Well, does the new person, should they get a percentage of that? They didn't develop the cultivation. So there's a lot of reasoning behind this, but mostly it's to protect the donors and make sure that the fundraiser is always thinking about the donor's intent and the donor's relationship first. Because in the hierarchy of who has priority, it should always be the best interest of the donor should be at the top of that hierarchy, even above the best interest of the nonprofit organization. And so some fundraisers have faced a lot of ethical dilemmas where maybe their organization wanted them to solicit a donor for a gift, but it wasn't in the donor's best intent. Maybe that donor needed to be concerned about things like their own long-term health care or their children or grandchildren. So sometimes a good ethical professional fundraiser might have to turn away a gift if it's not in the donor's best intent. And that's probably the toughest thing to do.
Let me take the other side for a minute. Whether you're paid on a salary or by commission, in the end, if you're not making your number, you're going to get fired. So functionally, isn't it the same? And to use your own point, you say that small nonprofits are often at a very big disadvantage. They don't, you know, to compete with the thousands of other nonprofits in getting donations. Well, a small, nascent nonprofit could be have a wonderful mission, but they don't have the money to pay somebody to be a fundraiser. So they say, you know, we're just starting out. We'll pay you, as you said, 10% of everything that you bring in. Is that really unethical?
It is, because I think the donors need to know that their money is being used in the way they intend it to use. And I can tell you that if you as a donor just, you know, put yourself in that position. If you as a donor gave $250 to an organization and you knew that $25 of that immediately went to the fundraiser, it kind of creates an environment where it's a transaction-based sale rather than a relationship building.
You know, I don't buy it. I'll tell you why. Because if you're, you know, I'm going to get paid, if I'm a professional fundraiser, whether I'm paid 10% or I'm paid a salary, if I'm the donor, I know, for example, that you're getting paid a salary. So obviously a certain percentage of what I'm donating is going to go to your salary, whether it be a salary or commission. What am I missing?
Well, I think there's such a high level of things that you really need to think about in here. Just as an example, let's say a donor, and this was actually a true case, and one of the things that brought about this code of ethics through the AFP was, there was a consultant in a particular community who said, you know, I can get you a lunch with Mrs. So-and-so, and I think she'd be interested in donating to your cause. And so she arranged a lunch with this donor, and the donor ended up giving $1 million to this organization, and sure enough, they got a bill from the consultant for $100,000. Now, I think that's overly excessive compensation to arrange a lunch. So by working on a salary, you're working and you're getting paid for the hours you put in and you're getting paid for the expertise you lend to an organization. But to say that because I got a $1 million gift, I should get $100,000, I just don't think that's really a fair thing to the donor. And I think that donor would have been pretty unhappy to find out that her $1 million really only meant $900,000 for the organization.
All right, we'll give you the last word on that one. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Linda Lysakowski. She is the author of Fundraising as a Career, What Are You Crazy?, and the Nonprofit Consulting Playbook. I've heard two contradicting things about fundraisers. One of them is that really good fundraisers never have to close. You know, close like in, you know, Glengarry Ross. Got to close them. Never have to close a prospect. That when the relationship is right, the cause is right, the prospect will ask to write a check. I've also heard the opposite. You got to be a great closer, which is why nonprofits do, as you just said, love to hire former people in business, like former sales managers with a great record of closing sales, which is correct.
Well, actually, I think they're both correct. So I guess the answer is both of them, yes and no. I think it's there's a great deal to be said for cultivation. And the larger the gift, the more cultivation needs to take place. And when you're talking to major donors or planned givers, usually 90% of the time is spent building the relationship, cultivating the donor, learning about the donor's interests, and 10% is making the ask. But that 10% is also critical. At some point in time, you do have to make an ask. There are some fundraisers who love the cultivation part but don't feel comfortable making an ask, and they're not ever going to be successful fundraisers because people give for a lot of different reasons. But there's another old saying that I always like to quote, and that is that if you ask, you might not necessarily hear yes, but if you don't ask, you can guarantee that you're not going to hear yes, because if you haven't made the ask, you certainly aren't going to get anything. So there's, you know, in smaller gift fundraising, probably 90% of the time is making the ask, like sending out letters, making phone calls, doing whatever. But in major gifts, 90% of the time is typically spent in cultivating that relationship. But you do have to spend that 10% making the ask. So I guess I'm taking both sides of that coin.
Well, you know, staying on the ethics thing, you know, you say that 90% for significant gifts is spent on cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, one could raise ethical questions about that. Isn't that really manipulative? It's not like the fundraiser is trying to develop a relationship with the person because she likes him or dislike or likes him or whatever. She's using it to get that person to have this emotional relationship, this emotional connection, so they end up making the big donation. Isn't there something unethical about that? Shouldn't really, in an idea, you know, if we're really focusing on ethics here, if we're saying that commission is unethical, if we're going to have that high a level of ethical standards, should it not be true that a person, let's say somebody like me, I'm well aware of the millions of charities that exist, causes. I don't have to even see an advertisement. There's heart disease, there is poverty, there is, education, whatever it is. I don't need to be, quote, cultivated, taking my time, manipulating me to get me to care more about them because of the relationship, rather than a clear-headed, objective analysis of what's going to be the best cause. For example, by looking at Charity Navigator, isn't it really unethical to be spending 90% of the paid fundraiser's time on cultivation?
Well, I think the word cultivation is not really so much trying to manipulate someone, but it's learning about the donor and learning about their interests and learning what really excites them. So when you're cultivating those relationships, you also have to remember that you're not cultivating relationship between the fundraiser and the donor. You're cultivating that donor's relationship with your organization. So you want to find out, is this really an organization that the donor is excited about, and is this something that they really feel passionate enough about? So you're trying to find out not so much, you know, how much they're worth, although that's part of it too. You do have to do some research because you don't want to ask $1 million from a donor who can't afford to give $1 million. You want to try to hone in on what their interests are, what their linkage is to your organization. Have they, you know, maybe you're a institution of higher education. Did they meet their spouse while they were in college at your facility, and how does that affect their life? And you want to really find out about the donor, not so much, you know, just manipulate them into doing something that's not good for them or that they don't want to do. It's building a relationship so they feel comfortable with your organization. And sometimes that cultivation leads nowhere because you find out the donor is really not interested in you as the Heart Association because their parent died of a cancer, and so they're really interested in giving to the Cancer Society, and that's fine. You know, then it's learning what's best for the donor. And so a good ethical fundraiser will oftentimes even point a donor to another charity, because it's more where the donor's interests lie. So it's not so much manipulating. It's really bringing the donor out. And, you know, giving makes people feel good. I don't think anybody's ever written a check to a charity and felt terrible afterwards. So you want to bring about a relationship that makes the donor feel good about their giving.
I will say, you know, I am hit up all the time. I have my PhD and master's degree from Berkeley. I am hit up all the time by UC Berkeley fundraisers. And when I talk about that, I feel that it is not the most cost-effective charity. They have never, ever suggested I do anything other than they give me some more reasons why I should donate to Berkeley. In the real world, is it really true that how often will a fundraiser try to say, well, you know, I really got to know your values and your interests. I think you'd be better off donating elsewhere. How often does that occur?
I think it happens more than we think, but it does take some doing to get to the level of that professionalism. And part of the reason is what we started out with, talking about the expectations that are put on fundraisers. And if a fundraiser is working in an organization who doesn't understand this and they're saying, okay, well, you need to perform, here's your goal, and why aren't you reaching it, and you need to bring in the money, if those kind of expectations are set, then I think that does lead fundraisers to maybe compromise a little bit on their professionalism. But my answer to, you know, the boards and the executive directors that hire people and say, well, we're paying based on performance, is they don't hire other people in their organization and say to them, let's say you're a human service agency, a counseling center, you don't hire a caseworker and say, you know, you need to bring in 60 new cases because otherwise that's what it costs us to pay your salary, so you need to bring in new cases. They don't treat other staff that way, but sometimes they do tend to treat the fundraising staff that way, and it's not fair to the fundraiser, but it's an educational process. I think we as fundraisers really need to educate our boards, our executive directors, our presidents, and the general community about what fundraising is really all about.
You know, early in the interview, you talked about that one of the great, you were in banking, and one of the real values that somebody coming from the private sector bring to the public sector is, in fact, that there is being businesslike. And, in fact, so many businesses do have very concrete benchmarks, you know, for accomplishment. Why is it not appropriate that even in, you know, if you are working in the counseling department of a nonprofit, that your success rate, your let's say you're dealing with ex-felons, their recidivism rate, or teachers who are, you know, if their students are achieving higher than their socioeconomic status would predict, why isn't it appropriate, if you're really a professional organization, that the amount of money you bring in ethically shouldn't that not be the major criterion for determining whether you stay employed or get a raise?
I think it should be one of the criteria. However, I think, you know, there's in development and fundraising, I think there's monetary goals and there's non-monetary goals, and all of those things need to take place. So let's say a fundraiser is hired to start a brand new development office. This organization's never raised money before. They need to do some things like creating awareness. So some of their goals could be tied around, you know, have you held cultivation events for donors? Have you gone out and visited donors? Have you increased the size of our database? Have you developed a much better newsletter or an annual report or a website? So it needs to really look at all of the things, the monetary goals and the non-monetary goals, to determine whether a person's really performing well or not.
You know, it was interesting I was just thinking back when you were talking about that cultivation should be creating a relationship, not with between the fundraiser and the donor, but the donor and the organization.
Right.
But I think about how much of fundraising are these gala events, which, you know, my wife's a superintendent of schools in Napa County, and so we go to a million of them. And they really are mainly, yes, they spend 5 or 10 minutes talking with the little slideshow about the wonderful things they did for children or whatever. But 99% of it is schmoozing, networking. It is all about relationship building, laughing, as I said, Vegas night, costume night, fishermen's whatever, you know. And to what extent does all of these gala events, which are really at so, I see them in every nonprofit, to what extent does that actually demean the whole nonprofit enterprise?
Well, I think what it does is a lot of times the general public thinks of fundraising only as events. And when you hear people talk about fundraising, a lot of people don't realize there is anything beyond events. Events are fine if they are mission-driven and if you're holding maybe one or two a year. But I can tell you that so many organizations are just so event-driven. I actually do a presentation called The 12-Step Cure to Event Addiction. Sometimes people are like, well, what do you mean we're addicted to events? But they are, because they just have so many events. And when you look at the net profit of events, typically an organization, if they're bringing in $500,000 at an event, the profit is usually about $250,000, because most of it is spent on meals and bands and all the other little frills and things that go along with these various different events. So many donors are getting to the point where they don't really want to attend events anymore, because they know so little of it is actually going to the charity.
Yep. I need to give it, one of the charities I donate to is called the Children's Medi Fund, and I want to tell you about them, both to get your reaction to it as well as to give it a shout-out. Phyllis Kaplan is basically a one-woman thing, and she cares profoundly about the poor children of Guatemala and of Thailand. And so she takes the donations, and with no overhead, she simply flies to Guatemala once or twice a year to help children get what they deserve and need in terms of education or some pleasure in their. These are sick kids or orphans, etc. And all her marketing is, she sends an email newsletter once a year that simply says, this is what I did, A, B, C, D, and E, and if you'd like to donate, just click here. And I just love her, and I feel like she does such yeoman's work. I just think that little nonprofits like that are heroic. What's your reaction to that?
I agree with you 100%. I have a client that's a free medical clinic also that just provides the most fantastic doctors, and their staff is just amazing. And, you know, they're doing this mainly with volunteers, doctors who volunteer their time to come in and work with folks. And I just think organizations like that really deserve a lot of credit for what they're doing. As long as they're doing things professionally, and I think it'd be great if she could send out a newsletter maybe more than once a year just to maintain contact with her donors. But I know all those things take time. But I think that's something that an organization can really benefit from, getting the word out to as many people as possible and maybe asking people to tell their friends about it. So, because I think those kind of groups really deserve a lot of credit for what they're doing. And fortunately, the most exciting thing to me about working in the nonprofit sector is the number of stories like this that I hear, that people who are so dedicated to a cause, and really many have given up their whole lives to work with organizations like this. And that's, to me, the most rewarding part about a career in the nonprofit sector.
You know, somehow, and I misspoke, she doesn't send an email. She sends one on a piece of 2-cent colored dark blue, pretty blue paper once a year. And there's something about the fact that it is only once a year, that she's not hitting me up. You know, she's not using constant comment to build the relationship and all that. There's something that feels more authentic. It makes me more want to give than if I got a quarterly newsletter from her. It feels less commercial, which is, if you're trying to donate to a nonprofit, you don't want it to be too slick. Am I wrong?
Well, I think it depends on the nonprofit, and it also depends on the donor. You know, there are some donors who do like to be contacted more often. And again, it goes back to that building relationships. This is part of the cultivation. If you're my donor and I know that you love that once-a-year mailing, that's all you're going to get. But you may have other donors who like to be, maybe they like to hear from you 3 or 4 times a year. Well, then you can send a special newsletter or email or something just to those people. It's knowing the donor and what really excites them. I agree, though. I think some organizations just totally overdo it. You know, the people who you send them a check and 2 weeks later you have another request for a check again.
Exactly.
It's kind of wear you out a little bit.
You know, I had mentioned Smile Train, and I originally had read an article about them and how amazing, for $250 you'd completely change a kid's life for sure by playing as Jeff Palin. But after I made that donation, exactly as you said. I have been inundated with direct mail, with email, with glossy brochures, with all this other crap, and I stopped donating. It just felt like they were too into the marketing angle.
Right, and I can tell you, I've stopped donating to some organizations who have hit me up too many times, but I've also stopped donating to people who just simply seem like they forgot about me. And there's been a lot of research done in this area, and about two-thirds of donors typically stop supporting an organization just because they think the organization doesn't really know or care about them as a donor.
Let me, before I let you go, just two more questions I want to ask you. One is, you know, you make a living as a consultant to nonprofits. And in fact, you know, millions of unemployed people claim to be consultants.
Right.
You know, what really is a perhaps non-obvious and viable way to make at least a middle-class living as a consultant
to nonprofits? Well, I think that's a great question. And if you're going to be a consultant, you really do need to take it seriously. Not, well, I'm a consultant because I got fired from this job and I haven't found another one yet. You have to make up your mind if you really truly want to be a consultant. And I know there are folks who are in and out of consulting. One minute they're a consultant, and 2 weeks later they're working for an organization.
Right.
And then 3 months later they're a consultant
right.
again. And that gives the true consultants a bad name. So consulting has to be a full-time profession. And if you're doing it because you think you're going to have a much easier job, you're probably not, because now you're, in addition to doing the work, you also have to run a business and do marketing and everything else that goes along with it. But consulting can be more lucrative. Lots of times when people hear the fees that consultants charge a day, they think, wow, that consultant's really charging a lot of money. They must be very wealthy. But they also don't realize that running a business means that you are having expenses like staffing and an office and, you know, marketing and registration alone. In most states in this country charge consultants an annual fee to be registered if they're going to be working in that state. So if you're going to work nationally, you may have to register in multiple states, and it gets quite expensive.
Yeah.
So you have to think about those things if you're going into consulting. But to me, it's a great career for people who, like myself, get bored easily. And, you know, you kind of feel like you've been in one organization long enough and, gosh, I've accomplished everything I can here. And I really love the variety of working with a whole varied group of clients, from the arts to the environment to education to healthcare and religion. I mean, I just love working with the variety of people that
right.
I work with.
Let's deal with what many of my listeners are: those people who got fired or not working, and would love to be a fundraising consultant. If let's say Marty Nemko, if I were one of those people, I'm somebody who is 40 or 50 years old, and I'm laid off, and you know, a 40, 50 year old, you know, who's not a super genius computer programmer or super high-powered successful person is going to have a hard time finding a job. So I say, okay, I want to try to see if I can make it as a nonprofit consultant. Would you say you're crazy, you can't do that from there? What would you tell me to do honestly?
Well, I think if you have enough years in the field, that's one of the important things, is you have to have some experience. You can't just come out of college and all of a sudden be a consultant if you've never worked in the nonprofit sector. But if you've worked in the nonprofit sector for a number of years and you have the experience, then go for it. If you don't have that level of experience, what my advice would be is to find a mentor, maybe find another consultant who you can do some subcontracting with,
mm-hmm.
and work with them and learn from them, and then eventually maybe go out on your own. A lot of consultants have gotten their start working
mm-hmm.
for some of the bigger firms and
mm-hmm.
then have gone out on their own.
On that point of agreement and enthusiastic head nodding, I want to thank you, Linda Lysakowski, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Yeah, well, thank you, Marty, and hello to all of your listeners, and hopefully some of them will now consider a nonprofit career, maybe if they weren't thinking about it before.
Yeah, and you've got your two books, which is Fundraising as a Career, What Are You Crazy?, a very short, simple read, and then the Nonprofit Consulting Playbook, Winning Strategies from 25 Leaders in the Field. And so those books are available, as well as some free articles, on your website. What's that website?
Right, it's lyndalysakowski.com.
Okay.
I know Lysakowski's hard to spell.
Don't you have one that's...
A- OWSKI.
Yeah. Isn't there one that's something the name of your publishing thing? What isn't there another?
Oh, Charity Channel Press is charitychannel.com.
Will that get you to the same place? Will that get you to the same place, charitychannel.com?
It'll get you to my books.
Oh, but not to your website. Okay, so your website, you really want to say it again. What's the website you want to send people to?
LindaLysakowski.com.
And that's LYSAKOWSKI.com.
Right.
Linda, thanks for here's a little bit of a tip. You might want to change that name so it's got better name record, better, easier to remember. Okay, anyway, Linda, thanks a lot for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay. Thank you, Marty.
Take care. Bye-bye. And now I want to turn to you, my dear listeners. If you or someone you love has got a work-related problem in the nonprofit sector, for-profit sector, don't know what the hell sector you should be in, I usually can help you. What I do, what are called three-minute workovers. The phone number here at KALW, 415-841-4134. That's the number here for Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Of course, it's free, so you got not much to lose. So in the meantime, you know, I had a couple of weeks ago, I had read, I've been writing this this continuing saga that AOL is going to be publishing called Days of Our Work Lives. And I read you a couple of the episodes, and I've had some listeners ask me, and I took a week off and wanted to see what happened if I missed a week, if listeners would say, well, what happened in the saga? And I did get some people saying they'd like to hear it. So let me read episode 3 of Days of Our Work Life. This is called Heart to Heart. Mike had already been told he was adios. The big enchilada acts fast. She was trained that bosses, especially female bosses, need to be seen as decisive. Confident he'd never get laid off, Mike had agreed when his wife said she wanted to stay at home. After all, he was working for a big, solid company. He could program in Python, Ruby, C, Visual Basic, and Hadoop. Those are the most in-demand languages. And while no one could accuse Mike of being a workaholic or a ninja programmer, he certainly wasn't a layabout. Well, Mike's ending up on the list was pretty much bad luck. If only that up-and-comer hadn't tried to show how cost-conscious he was by suggesting that the company could find plenty programmers with 5-star customer ratings on Odesk for $15 an hour and didn't have to pay benefits, no security of employment. Now, David, who was Mike's co-worker, was no hugger. But this was one of those rare times he actually wanted to hug the person. Not as the now obligatory evidence of being a modern male, but because he truly felt for Mike. And maybe to soothe himself. After all, if one comment could put a good employer like Mike on the unemployment line, all it would take is for some co-worker to say, you know, David's relentless snarkiness is hurting morale. And David, too, would be pounding the pavement. And David couldn't bear to be Mr. Mom and collect unemployment checks. Suddenly, David felt pressure in his chest. Probably just the stress of thinking my job might not be so secure. But when the pain shot up into his neck and down his left arm, he knew he was having a heart attack. Mike, call 911. That's episode 3 of Days of Our Work Life. In any case, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, if you would like a 3-minute workover. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I feel like reading you one more episode to make up for last week that I didn't. So this next episode is called Meatballs. A month after his heart attack, David returned to work. Alas, as articles he had Googled indicated, his cognitive functioning wasn't quite what it was, nor his energy level. So it wasn't a total surprise when the big enchilada made him part of the next round of layoffs. For a moment, he considered invoking the Americans with Disabilities Act, but doing that would violate one of his core beliefs, that a person should be employed only on the merits, not because some law protects him. After all, if a law forces the employer to keep an employee where the employee could find someone better, it means a more qualified person is denied the job. It means that the co-workers are denied a better co-worker, and instead may need to carry part of the employee's load. And the company's products and services end up worse, thereby hurting the customers and the shareholders. No, David knew he had to go quietly. But now what? Despite weeks with plenty of time to think about it, he didn't know. His wife Susan suggested he consider a lower-level job in his field. David, big data analytics is a super competitive field. How about some easier marketing job? But that would make his descent too obvious to himself. He needed something completely different. But who the hell would hire him in any sort of decent salary doing something completely different, in which he had no training or experience, especially with his now just average cognitive functioning and energy? Should he go back to school? He hadn't been in school for 20 years, and now, with his memory not so good, it seemed too daunting. Besides, those years in school would not only be years without income, but would cost them serious dollars in tuition. And of course, there is degree proliferation. Today, it seems everyone's got a college degree and nearly everyone's got a graduate degree. Getting a master's in something would not sufficiently differentiate him, let alone be the wisest use of his time and money, even assuming he could get into and complete a decent master's program. Well, maybe I should start my own business. But what? And most businesses fail, especially those run by people who are starting their first business. Geez, I never have shown any entrepreneurial interest. As a kid, I never even met a lemonade stand. But Susan said, why don't we try a really simple business, like selling meatball sandwiches from a cart near a train station? You always said my meatballs were the best in the world. Figuring there was nothing to lose by writing a one-page mini business plan, they did. They even came up with a name, Balls of Joy. And for the first time in a long time, David got excited and Susan got excited, until they encountered 1 pound that threw cold water on their meatballs. The California Food Code. And that was episode 4. If you'd like to hear me do more episodes in future editions of the show, just email me, mnemco@comcast.net. If you like it, I'll do it. If you don't like it, I won't do it. mnemco@comcast.net. That's mnemco@comcast.net. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello. It's you.
Hello, Marty.
Yes.
Marty. About 4 weeks ago, you interviewed Robert Greene, and just so happened, I walked out of a Subway sandwich shop, and I looked down, and there was a small garbage can, and I saw this book. It was The 48 Laws of Power.
Right,
Power.
That's his book.
And I really started getting into it, and I was really fascinated by it.
Right.
I know books like this, and say like the and a book like Prince, Machiavellian's Prince, it kind of shows you the depth of human nature, and it reveals a lot about the human nature of people that you have to work and deal with. Can you comment, Marty, on the nuances of how you don't swallow the whole thing? But I know it's got to be nuanced. In a way, can you just kind of help me see like the truth about it? What's true about it and what's not? And
absolutely. Let me do that. First of all, let me point out, he was on the show to talk about his book Mastery, which was a look at 40 or 50 different great accomplishers and what they did to achieve mastery. But his most famous book is The 48 Laws of Power. And because Robert Greene was such a good guest, I have invited him back next month to talk about that very book, The 48 Laws of Power. I have read it, and here are my thoughts about it. I think that it's like everything, like most things in life. Humankind is not all nefarious. There is a normal distribution of people. There are some who are pure saints, there are some who are pure sinners, and most of us are somewhere in the middle. And the wisest human being is neither completely cynical about humankind, because that tends to bring out the worst in them, nor being a Pollyanna and naive. It is being alert and aware of all of the negative ploys and manipulations that people can do without assuming that they're all trying to manipulate you as nefariously as possible. Of course, we are all trying to manipulate each other. Every time when I ask my wife, let's say I'm really in the mood for Thai food, you know, I'm going to subtly try to suggest ways to get her to buy into going out for Thai food. It doesn't make me evil. So it is this balancing notion. I think that book, 48 Laws of Power, are outstanding in two regards. One, it helps sensitize you to the various kinds of things that people can do to get you to do their bidding. And it also, as long as you're using these techniques for positive ends, sometimes ends justify certain means. Nothing he advocates is going to be necessarily, you know, he's not asking you to kill anybody or to devastate people. He's just asking you to use the various power relationships in a way to get people to do your bidding. And that can always be done for good and for evil. Is that at all helpful?
Very much so. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco. We only have a couple of minutes left, and so I'm going to try to use the time to share a couple of my favorite. I really love tweeting because it forces me to essentialize my best ideas in 140 characters or less, and it's a way of archiving my best ideas. So here are a few that I have not mentioned on the show before that I tend to like. I do think that video is a ever more useful tool. For example, I just created a whiteboard video, some people call it a doodle video, called 6 Ways to Help Teachers Better Meet the Needs of Gifted Kids in a Regular Class Without Doing Undue Work. Well, that video already I've gotten a lot of praise from some pretty powerful people who say that they're going to disseminate it. I do more to, you know, we are visual. They often say if you tell somebody, they might remember. If you show them, they're much more likely to remember. So using video, whether it be a video to help a small nonprofit better make their case. So if you're looking for a self-employment idea, I think thinking about if you've got, there's so many people in the Bay Area who love video, who like writing scripts, who like using a camcorder. Being somebody who creates videos for small businesses or nonprofits, even a video that's going to be posted on somebody's Facebook page, a small businesses or nonprofits Facebook page, I think that's an interesting career direction. The next tip I want to offer is somebody, and I don't remember the name of the company, but there was a company where they had, there was somebody who was in their communication department, but they called his title Chief Storytelling Officer. It is true, for better or worse, I really think that stories often can be used for manipulation rather than really giving the unbiased facts about things, but humankind is very influenced by story. So think about if you are in marketing, if you are in PR, if you are in communications, whether for nonprofit, government, or for-profit, think of yourself as a chief storytelling officer. It makes you, it reminds you of the primacy of story. And finally, this is not directly related to career, but it's so potent. My marriage, I've been with my wife, Barbara, for 41 years now, and it's basically been a good marriage, but we had trouble about 15 years ago. And what we did was we had found an article, a book actually, called The Marriage Summit. And in the end, it's a very potent tool for fixing a troubled relationship. It really took us out of the doldrums. And I wrote an article. So if you would just Google The Marriage Summit, you'll see it's a pretty simple yet potent way to improve your marriage. And I'll just tell you briefly what it is. Basically, we took a few minutes to discuss each of the major components of our life, money, sex, children, career, etc., and agreed on one thing that each of us wanted to change. Not what they wanted the other person to change, that each of us wanted to change. Then we met once a week over dinner. We went out to dinner to Skates in Berkeley and asked each other, how are each of us doing on it? That, in a nutshell, is it. But Google that, you'll get more details. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And so many people would like a career outdoors working with plants. Well, I will talk with Sloat Garden Center manager Dustin Strobel about careers in a plant nursery. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.